Welcome to Rebalancing Act. We are Leslie Ann Saintamore and Kieran Waterhouse, lawyers and more importantly, friends. We know climate change is happening and that we need to solve it. So join us for conversations and discussions around climate solutions, mitigation, and what we can all be doing. Today, we're talking climate modeling.
So we're back?
We're back. It's so exciting. Are you excited?
I am back with some more climate solutions. I also had an excellent winter break, I would say, but I'm excited to be producing some more content.
I would second both of those thoughts. I agree. And I think today's content will be interesting. It's kind of like...
I am intrigued.
Not a typical solution in that it's not something we are newly creating or doing. But it's, I think, an aspect of solutions that we don't talk about too much. And I wanted to think about and talk about a little bit.
Tell me more, Leslie.
I will.
No, this is it. This is the episode.
I hope you can picture the amount that I am gesturing as I say these things.
Now I can.
Normally do.
Excellent.
We are going to talk about climate modeling. And I want you to know I'm, like, voguing as I say this.
Jazz hands.
All of the above. Strike a pose. Everything. So, when I say climate modeling, what do you kind of think of, just to start us off?
I think about that little bar, the hockey stick graph, that's showing that the climate's getting warmer. And, you know, the extent to which... I would say that as at a basic level. And then I also think about, I guess two other things. Oh, I have a lot of thoughts about climate modeling. But one of them being, I guess, you know, people discussing and debating the extent to which different natural processes will change, like what will the impact actually be. And then the second is a bone I have to pick with people who... we'll read climate models based on us not changing our behavior and be like, well, that's just what's going to happen. And I'm like, no, you don't understand how modeling works. We can change this future. So those are some of my thoughts.
I like those thoughts. As an aside, at the mention of hockey stick graph, I now want to go Google, and maybe I will make this as an aside if I find something interesting. Do non-North Americans also call them hockey stick graphs?
I think they do.
I love that.
I think so. Yeah. Because you also have field hockey for those non-Canadians, too.
That's true. Although that would be a much more drastic graph. They are a shorter blade.
It's true, and it's curvy. That's very true.
Intriguing. Anyway, beyond the sports involved in graph making, I... did some little bit of a deep dive into what is climate modeling and how good are we at it, actually, which was kind of interesting. So for anyone who's wondering, what is climate modeling? It is not, sadly, when you draw a picture of the sun with a cute little face and pretend that it is a model climate.
That is sad.
I wish. I would also like to point out that was not a joke I planned ahead of time. I just came up with it. So, in many ways, climate modeling is kind of like an extension of weather forecasting in that you look at what's been going on, you look at the different factors, and you project. But instead of looking at weather over a period of hours or maybe days, you're looking at changes that take place over generally decades. The models are based on well-documented physical processes that simulate the transfer of energies and materials through our climate system. Our climate system, of course, being different processes that primarily happen in the atmosphere, our oceans, on land, and things like that. These different processes are represented through mathematical equations about how these things interact. And through that, they can build a very complex process with a lot of math that I don't understand, that quantify these processes, represent them, and they can pop in variables to represent different conditions to start with and the subsequent conditions as we change things. And so, for example, some of the different variables they might be looking at are current levels of CO2 in the atmosphere when they start their model, looking at the rate at which which greenhouse gases are output. They could be looking at the speeds at which water evaporates into the atmosphere in different parts of the world. All of these different processes are mixed together to create these models. And this makes so much sense, what I'm about to say, and it's almost embarrassing and never occurred to me as a thing that happens. So once you make a model, so I took a lot of math in high school, okay? And my biggest gripe about my choices in life, not following the career path of being a marine biologist, okay, maybe not the biggest gripe, that's that I don't get to play with a lot of fish, but one of the gripes is that it's really hard to check if you have a right answer in law and poli-sci and policy work, because there's a billion right answers. But in math and a lot of sciences, you can check your answer. And that's what they can do with climate models. They do something called hindcasting. So you set up your model and you stick in the variables from 30, 40 years ago and then run your model and see if it's accurate to what actually happened. Which just makes perfect sense. And I don't know why it never occurred to me that that's how they would do this.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
It does.
And it makes me really jealous because I want to be able to check my answers.
I feel that.
But we have to go to court to do that. And that's a process.
And I wouldn't even necessarily describe that as the correct answer necessarily. That's the answer according to laws, but yes. Not always the same thing.
Very true. Very true. And so a lot of our models are actually very, very accurate, which is reassuring to know, and something I kind of hoped was true, but I really had no idea. But it makes sense as to why they can be so accurate when we test them like this. So that was really exciting.
Who's making these models, Leslie-Ann?
So generally, they are researchers around the world, often embedded at universities or government organizations. For example, NASA in the U.S. does some of these modeling and predictions. There are folks at different universities in the U.K. who do some of it. As well as sometimes, it's interesting, industry will do some. And I say some because a lot of these models build off of each other in certain ways, the way science does. You know, you stand on the shoulders of giants. But some of these models will be built to look at slightly different avenues, look at slightly different variables, things like that. So you're also seeing the private sector in areas like insurance starting to develop models to be able to understand what their risks are as well, which is really interesting. And I'll get into a couple other organizations later on that do some more specific ones.
Excellent.
Yeah. So the forecasting we do is quite accurate. But recently, in the last few years, as of about 2019-ish, we've been realizing there is one area of the modeling where we've been kind of inaccurate. Do you have any guesses as to what area that might be?
I think it might be sea level rise.
Ooh. You were more specific than I was expecting, but like also accurate still in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So, while we can predict what the climate's going to look like, we've been kind of wrong in terms of what we think the impacts will look like. And not in a good way.
Yeah, I think that's been a big thing.
Yeah, we've been underestimating the impacts, which no me gusta. So it's not that climate change has been going faster than we expected. The warming is in line with the models, but the warming we're seeing is having a bigger impact than we expected. There was a study in 2019, for example, that was a really big study that I'm not going to explain all of it because there's a lot of factors involved and they looked at a lot of different industries. But they broadly found that in most cases, the impacts of climate change were being seriously underestimated and would be more severe than what we've been preparing for. And so
totally, especially because a lot of our preparation has been like, let's pretend this is not happening.
Yeah. In some of the areas they were looking at, they were finding that up to 75% of the impacts they were modeling were being underestimated from what was actually happening.
To me, that also broadly resonates with how the scientific method works a little bit, especially when you're trying to do science at a consensus level, which I'm really glad that they are modeling things and accounting for those more severe impacts than we thought. But like, it just is interesting to me because in some ways, pedagogically, that almost makes sense.
Can you elaborate on that? Because I'm not sure I know what you mean and why.
Yeah, well, I guess I find, you know, science, the scientific method stops people from stating things affirmatively unless there is like so much evidence in favor of it.
Mm.
And I think you see a lot of that with the COVID media, for example. When Omicron emerged, I think there was evidence in, you know, some evidence, I don't even know what the right words to use are, but there was evidence essentially that Omicron was more mild.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that did turn out to be the case. You know, one can discuss the degrees to which and the more specifics of that, but like, I think broadly speaking, that has been a conclusion that more people have come to draw. But for the first like month, 6 weeks, significant period of time, scientists were very cautious about making affirmative statements at all about Omicron severity. You know, even going so far as to say language of there's no evidence to suggest or no evidence to confirm that it's more mild. Just to me, which I'm not saying this is a bad thing at all. I think that the problem is that, I mean, it's not a problem. I think that the reality is that science isn't going to, you know, or for a long time when it wasn't as certain about climate impact, it wasn't going to broadcast them in a very aggressive, affirmative way until they had been thoroughly researched.
Does that make sense? Yeah, I do agree. And I think that might be part of it. But I do think it's interesting in that, you know, it's not for a lack of necessarily evidence that they're not saying, you know, we're expecting these major events. It's that that wasn't the evidence they were seeing based on their modeling, which is interesting. But it's also interesting because they did find a number of what they call false alarms, areas in which they were modeling for more severe impacts than they were seeing, which was also kind of interesting. And those happened in the situations they were looking at primarily around water resources. And part of that was because of the way that the water resources in the area are so managed because of hydropower that it almost, the impacts weren't as major because they were being so managed on a regular basis that I think unintentionally people were mitigating those major impacts.
That is interesting. Water use is so interesting to me because I think there isn't that great a knowledge of how the system works, just in the sense that water management does play such a big role. And, you know, people think about turning off the tap, taking fewer or shorter showers, and those things do matter. But when you look at water usage, for example, like municipal water usage for lawns or even water usage for heavy industry, those things are actually a huge proportion of water usage, and like better management of those tools can actually make up such a big percentage of the difference.
Totally. Yeah. I think water use is something that I think, you know, we're starting to talk more about, you know, on the podcast, but I think also a lot of countries, I should rephrase that. In Canada and the US, I find we haven't been talking about water enough. A lot of other countries have had to because they don't have the same amount of it we have, and we're very lucky in that sense. But I do think we're starting to have to realize that, you know, we don't have endless water and it is a resource that we have to actually think about which is...
Totally.
Yeah, it's good to see, but it's kind of, it's concerning it's taken us this long.
Well, honestly, not to divert too much, but I feel like that's always been the case and we've just ignored it. Like, think about how much pollution of watersheds we've just allowed to happen in Canada for a long time without any acknowledgement of what that means.
Totally. Also, was that an intentional, like, water management pun with the diverting? Because it made me laugh.
No, it wasn't at all.
I liked it. Props to you. And so I mentioned I would talk about a couple other specific organizations that are developing models. And so a couple that I wanted to mention are, as many folks who are listening might be aware of, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, which back in 2000 put together four possible scenario families to describe possible future conditions based on the way emissions may climb over the next several decades. And
so, or decline.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking about that. I don't know that any of those four original scenario families did look at a overall decline in emissions at that time.
I'm not sure, but I know that they were in... We're living in a different world than I think many of those scenarios. In a better way.
Oh, yes. But, okay, yeah. I will get to those. You're jumping ahead on me, Kieran.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay. So they developed their four possible emission families for the way the emissions that would climb over the 21st century may change and what those might look like. And for many years, folks were able to refer to those four scenarios in looking at their modeling, their mitigation, and things like that on both their local scale or when applying different solutions to a global scale, which is, I think, really interesting to be able to provide from a respected organization a couple different variations for folks to work with, because it allows you to be creating possible solutions and ideas that are actually comparable. Because I find so often in looking at climate solutions and science, we're all looking at different milestones, different criteria in decision making. And that can make it so hard to make a convincing argument in favor of a solution or draft a good policy, because you're all talking about different things.
Definitely. Yeah. Not apples to apples.
It does create this way we can be given comparable situations in developing these policies, which I think is really exciting. And then...
That is exciting.
As you mentioned, none of these scenarios are the context we're living in today. And back in 2013, climate scientists reevaluated where we're at and created a new set of what they call the representative concentration pathways, which I think are probably what you were thinking of, where we look at, yeah, different amounts of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and the trajectory we might be living in with those different concentrations. And so not only did it give us these comparable pathways, but it gives us a basis on which to be kind of evaluating solutions and then moving forward as well, which I think is a really interesting aspect of modeling, because it takes it from just the science and the looking at what we could have to sitting down and saying, based on where we're at now, these are the scenarios that we could be seeing. Let's give them to the public in a way that they can use them to evaluate their situation, their solutions, their policies, and take concrete change with them.
That's so interesting to me, because I don't actually think that that's how that worked. I think the thing about modeling that isn't discussed enough is that, to me, modeling doesn't really incentivize or provide people with an understanding of how they can implement solutions and how that'll actually make their lives better. And maybe that's just I haven't been looking at the right modeling. But I have found, like, media responses to modeling to be like, unless we do something, this is the future we're living in, which is in a sense true. And I think that's helpful that the model shows that because it is the truth. But like the something and the doing something to me, like sometimes gets a bit lost in the modeling conversation, which I think is unfortunate because it makes people feel like, again, you know, the models are predictive, but they also aren't necessarily a policy prescription for what's going to happen.
Definitely. And I think that's because I think that's what I like about the IPCC representative pathways, in that none of them are an actual pathway, or sorry, none of them are an actual model from what we have today. It's there laying out, if we take action, these are the avenues we could be living in. And it allows people to say, as a government, for example, to say, wow, if we don't take action and we go with pathway one, we're screwed. And it kind of, I think, gives that incentive to say, okay, ideally we want to be under pathway two because that's, you know, actually going to allow us to have X, Y, and Z. How can we try to get there? At the same time, if we don't get there and we're stuck under pathway three, how can we be preparing for mitigation in the meantime as well? And I think that's how I see these as different from the typical modeling, where modeling would just be like just the forecasting straightforward.
Totally. Though I guess, can I have one? Am I allowed to have one more bone to pick with the modeling?
Oh, totally.
my other thought about the modeling, which I totally agree with you, I think that is the best possible use of it, is like something I find is just not true of how change happens, and like we should be encouraged by this, is in a linear fashion. So I think there is much talk of 7% decline a year between 2018 and 2030, which we are not on the path of, to be clear. We've made a lot of progress, but we're not there. But the idea of like the 7% a year, which I find is a way that a model would demonstrate how change needs to occur. But in my mind, I think I picture like momentum and acceleration of change being what's the most change. What are all of the things we can do in 2022 to set ourselves up to make more change in 2023, to set ourselves up to make even bigger changes in 2024, transformative changes. And even if those changes in 2022 don't have the emissions decrease by the same amount, you know, if you set yourself up for transformative structural changes in the energy system, for example, you're going to get those necessary emissions reductions, which, I mean, I think it makes sense in a lot of ways, and it's really helpful to show how we're falling short when we look at the 7% a year. But at the same time, I also think that people don't really improve or make change 7% a year. Does that make sense?
It does. But I kind of think you're expecting too much of modeling in that sense.
That's fair.
Like, I don't think you can have an accurate model that would model for momentum of something that they can't quantify yet.
No. And I know that's true of models. I think it's more about how people talk about the models.
That's
how the non-modelers who are making the models are talking about the models that they read.
Kieran, I can only solve so many problems for the world in one podcast episode.
Totally. The modeling, though. High quality and very useful.
Although, based on your momentum curve, I do think that may be a field hockey stick graph.
Mm-hmm. Be encouraging.
Just throwing that out there.
Absolutely.
The other little aspect of modeling I wanted to talk about is kind of going a different direction with it. In that, what I also find really, really interesting about modeling is, in most cases, the models we're looking at are being done on a very big scale. Often, you know, they're only to the, like, 25 kilometers squared area is, like, as specific as they can get. Sometimes not even that.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have to be. Because you can also do really site-specific modeling, which I really find interesting and is something I really like to look at. As many of our listeners know, I really like Algonquin Park. And there's actually modeling that's been done specifically for the park on how different aspects of the park will be warming and what they'll look like under climate change projections. And I think that's really interesting because they can look at it on such a specific scale that lets you really say what is going to be happening in this area, what is going to be changing in this lake, what is going to be changing on this hillside, in a way that lets you really engage with the mitigation in a way that I think can be really helpful that you don't see in some of these bigger models. So, for example, when looking at modeling that's this specific, you can say, you know, this lake is likely going to be in this warming zone. And so these certain populations of fish will likely no longer be able to breed in this lake. So we want to prioritize the protection of the breeding grounds in the lakes that are in this different warming zone where that population can continue to exist. Or you can look at and say, you know, based on warming, we're going to be seeing less and less of this type of ecosystem. So let's move campgrounds out of that area of the park so that we can right now start to protect those sensitive ecosystems and their biodiversity as we approach the warming that'll be putting them in danger. And it's this
definitely
this level of modeling I think is so interesting in that you talk about how often people look at modeling and just say, huh, that's how it's going to be. But I think when you give people modeling at this level, they can see how it will impact them and their lives in a really tangible way. And it can let people take ownership of some of these solutions and mitigation in a way that I don't think you get when it's on such a large or global scale that, you know, they can't see how it'll actually affect them because everything is just a little bit warmer. What does that actually mean? But when you do the site-specific modeling, for example, one of the things they look at is how long ice is likely to be on certain lakes in the park, or changes like that, that, you know, actually affects people's lives and their habits and things like that. And I think that is where you get some of that ownership over modeling that you don't see on a bigger scale.
Definitely. And I think seeing changes like that also spur people to action.
Totally.
Oh, modeling, we ask so much of you.
I know.
I think we ask you to solve the climate crisis, and modeling can't do that alone, even though it is extremely useful.
It's so much more than just looking pretty. Although I would say we still do have some super models. I will see myself out. And that's all I got.
That was excellent. I think it's important, if there's anything to take away, it's really what modeling can and cannot do.
Totally.
And it can do a lot.
But it can't do everything.
It can't do everything. And I think we shouldn't ask it to either. No. And I think a huge thing that's happened for me, I think, in my perusal of LinkedIn, as I like to do, is seeing just the diversification of every job being a climate job. That I think 15, 20 years ago, honestly, if you wanted to work on the climate crisis, it was kind of like, oh, you become a modeler or a conservationist, or like, I think those were the main options. I'm sure there are others too, but just to show that you can, you know, you don't have to be working on modeling specifically. Like, you can also be somebody providing the broad adaptation solutions, as we were talking about.
Definitely. And I think it's really exciting to see these changes and to see, you know, the way we're working with models now that really do give us the ability to dream and imagine a new future in a way that I think when we were looking at very basic models that didn't look at the different possible pathways, we didn't have that same ability to, like, dream a good life.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, models. And thank you, Leslie Ann, for teaching us about them.
Anytime. I was giving Velma an opportunity to contribute, and she has said nothing.
Classic cat.
But we shall see you for our next episode coming up soon. And I'm really excited about it. So I hope everyone will continue to join us.
See you then.